Hey folks, can you hear me? How are you this morning? Good to see you again, or at least virtually see you. Going to give people a few more minutes to join in. While we're waiting, you're welcome to ask any questions you might have, but just anything. Doesn't have to be about today's class or about the project or whatever.
Professor, actually, I had a question.
Okay.
One of my project companies, I think this is actually for valuation, not for corporate finance, but it's a company that's in kind of high growth phase, and I'm trying to get a better understanding of like what are some good sources that you would use to get a sense of what like a target market size might be, or like what's reasonable.
It depends on the market, right? If it's a market which is mostly dominated by public companies like retail or auto, you can just add up the revenues of all of the companies in the space, which is what I would do. I'd go to CapIQ and add up the revenues. I mean, that's, I think, the easiest solution.
So
But
what
if
is it?
you're in a market that's unformed, then in a sense, you've got, I mean, there are a couple of public sites, but let's face it, we're all guessing, right? For instance, you're valuing Zoom. I mean, we really don't know how big the online, I mean, we don't even know what business it's in. Online education, online business, it could all change after this. But you can get bits and pieces. I mean, Google search, I mean, I just go through Google search and I type in the market and I keep looking at, I mean, 9 out of 10 sites are either just not giving me a number or they're charging me to come in and I'm not paying $500 to go into a site. I'm not even sure, but it's bits and pieces and it's just, I mean, it's almost like you have to get a bit here and a piece there and put it all together and make your best estimate because right now there are some markets where we're not quite sure.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, folks, welcome and I'm glad to see you guys again. I'm sorry about last week, but there's no way I could have done a session with Noah in my lab. He's just way too fidgety. So now we had a good time and he's back home with his parents and his little sister and she's tiny. She's about 5.5 pounds, so she came 4 weeks early, but thank God she's healthy and she's doing well so far. But I'm glad to be back. So before I start today, I want to nag you because I haven't had a chance to nag you in person for 10 days. I've nagged you on emails, but please, please, please do try to catch up on the project. And as I said, doing the optimal capital structure part actually will let you get caught up on the earlier parts of the project. So if you feel overwhelmed, you haven't even started on the project, my suggestion is start with the optimal capital structure because it'll do some of the dirty work for you. Estimate your current cost of capital, no cost of equity, it'll force you to think about betas. So get, you know, nothing else gets started. And if you can enter your numbers into that Google shared spreadsheet, it'll help me because I can see where you are in the project. And even if I see something that doesn't make sense, maybe email you and say, hey, that doesn't make sense. But if you can go to the Google shared spreadsheet and enter your numbers, and I thank those people who are already doing it, that'll be great. Because today's session, we're going to build on what we did last week. You know, we did it with, you know, the recorded sessions. And if you remember, I went through three or four different ways in which you can come up with the optimal debt ratio for your company. You could do the cost to capital approach and try to minimize the cost to capital, see what debt ratio your cost to capital is minimized at. The logic being, if you can minimize your discount rate, you're maximizing your value. And after all, that is the objective in corporate finance. The limitation of the traditional cost to capital approach, of course, is that it tends to keep the operating income fixed. Basically, you're keeping the numerator fixed and you're saying, if I change my debt ratio, my operating income will not change. You're saying, but it's operating income, it shouldn't change. But remember, we talked about indirect bankruptcy costs. If your rating drops, people might stop buying your products, your suppliers might start demanding cash. So the cost to capital approach, the basic cost to capital approach is built on the premise of, hey, if I change my debt ratio, no matter what my rating is, my revenues are not affected, my operating income is not affected. for the most part, I can live with that because that effect is going to show up only if my rating drops to double B, single B, triple C. But the enhanced cost to capital approach allows you to adjust the operating income for changes in your rating. Effectively, it says, hey, if my rating drops to double B, my operating income will drop by 20 or 25%. And what that allows you to do is then maximize the value by playing with both the operating income and the cost of capital. The third approach is the APV approach. I've been pretty open about my distrust of the approach. A lot of people out there use it, and you run into people, maybe even your managing director, if you end up working at an investment bank that is capital structure solutions or a consulting firm, will tell you, oh, the APV approach is the only way to do things right. And my suggestion is eke out from that person what they mean by the APV approach, because in the true APV approach, here's what you do. You calculate the value of your firm with no debt. Let's call that the unlevered firm value. You can either do it by doing a full-fledged valuation with the unlevered cost of equity as your discount rate, because we have no debt. That's what your cost of capital would be. Or you can back out from the current market value what the unlevered firm value is by removing the effects of debt. And then to that, you add the dollar effects of whatever debt you decide to take on in terms of the tax benefits you get from the debt and the expected bankruptcy costs. But I said in practice, people get the unlevered firm value, they get the tax benefits, and then they come and wave their hands about expected bankruptcy costs and say, too difficult to do, therefore I'm not going to do it. And their APV approach just then becomes unlevered firm value plus tax benefits. And if you stop there, that's not the APV approach. That's a pretty crappy way of coming up with optimal debt ratios because you're counting in all the good stuff, the tax benefits, and none of the bad stuff. So I fleshed out the rest of the APV approach, even though it's not my first choice. I said, you have to come up with expected bankruptcy costs by estimating a probability of bankruptcy at every debt ratio. And the way I do this is I use that synthetic rating that I get at the debt ratio to estimate a likelihood of default. So you're triple B rated, I said you have a 7.5% chance of default. And then a cost to bankruptcy, which is, you know, to be quite honest, a number that we really don't know much about. And I said somewhere between 10 and 40%, that's a pretty wide range. It might be 10% for a grocery store where there are very little indirect bankruptcy costs and 40% for Boeing where people are wary about it going bankrupt. And somewhere in the middle is going to fall your firm. And finally, I said the way most companies have debt ratios is not by optimizing their cost of capital using the APV approach. They look at everybody else in the sector. I call this Me Too corporate finance. You know, why is your debt ratio 30%? Because everybody else is at 30%. And I talked about why CFOs like this, because this way, if something goes wrong, their defense is, but everybody else was doing it. So with all of these approaches, I came up with optimal debt ratios for Disney. And the numbers were surprisingly close, right? They were 30 to 40%. Maybe with the industry average, I got a lower number, maybe 20%. But with every single approach, I found Disney to be underlevered. I found Vale to be overlevered, Tata Motors to be overlevered, and Bookscape and Baidu to be where they should be. So today what I'd like to do is build on what I have so far, because what I have right now is the optimal debt ratio for a company, right? But then I have an actual debt ratio, and I'm going to find one of three things. I'm going to find either that my firm has the right financing mix. What does that mean? My optimal is 30%. My actual is 26. In fact, if you're within 10% of your optimal, I would say you're pretty close to your optimal, right? If you're at 20, because remember, when we come up with an optimal debt ratio, we're making assumptions. There's a range on our estimate. It's hubris to say my optimal debt ratio is 41.36%. One reason I've designed my optimal capital structure spreadsheet to give you debt ratios at the 10th percentiles, because you'd see the optimal is 10% or 20%, it's never 22.55%. I could have designed that spreadsheet to actually give you a precise optimal by just setting up a solver function, but I don't want to do that because that gives you the false sense of, I know exactly what my optimal is. With Disney, I know roughly what the optimal is. It's around 40%. So if you're at 36 or 35%, I'm gonna say you're pretty close to the optimal. It could be that your firm is underlevered, there's too little debt. Your actual is 12%, my optimal is 40, which is what I got for Disney, it's underlevered. Or your firm is overlevered, it has too much debt. If you're gonna have a problem, which one should it be? Underlevered or overlevered? Which problem would you rather have in your company? This is an easy one. Would you rather have your firm? Oh, absolutely. If you're going to screw up, it's better to have too little debt. And in the, and you can see why, right? A crisis like this, hold on to the fear factor that you get out of this crisis. Because once you go out there and you start your own company and you become a CFO, or if that's your end game, or even an investment banker suggesting a capital structure solution, hold on to the fear you feel right now, because that fear will fade over time. And as things get good, people tend to forget the downside of that, the dark side of debt. If you're going to make a mistake, it's better to have too little debt. But if you have an actual debt ratio that's different from the optimal, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. What do I do next? And that's what I want to spend today talking about. Should I go to the optimal? And if so, how quickly should I move to the optimal? You see, what if my firm has the right debt ratio? Remember the Hippocratic Oath? Do no harm. If your company's actually doing the right thing, don't feel the urge to tell them to do something different. It's one thing that worries me about consultants in general is if you're hired as a consultant, you come into a firm and I ask you, what should I do? And you look at what I'm doing and I'm already doing the right thing. You feel a little guilty, right? Because if you tell me I'm doing the right thing, you feel like you haven't earned your pay. So what do? You give me a recommendation to do something. You feel that doing something is better than doing nothing. But that's not true. If you're already at your optimal, just let it go, right? So this part of your project might become very simple for you. My firm is already at its optimal. It's at the cost of capital. It should be. Let me move on. But if your actual is different from the optimal, let's talk about what to do next. And I'm going to use a flow chart, which I find useful in deciding what to do next. So let me go through this flow chart. And if you have your optimal for your firm, great, because you can go along with this flow chart with me as I go through this. The first question I'm going to ask you is your actual debt ratio greater or lesser than the optimal? Okay? Let's take the better branch first. Let's suppose you're under level, you have too little debt. I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Is your firm a potential takeover target? You're saying, why would having too little debt make my firm a potential target for a takeover? Why would having too little debt make you a potential target for a takeover, especially a hostile takeover? Anybody?
Well, I'm guessing if you have very little debt, then a PE firm is able, like, has the band room to take more debt.
In other words, it's almost like you're selling a coat with $100 in the coat pocket, right? So if you're under levered, you're effectively allowing an acquirer the room to go out and borrow money using your assets as backing and buy you out. Basically, and I'll give you an analogy. It's not a very good one, but hang in there. Let's assume you buy a house. You buy a house in the New York tri-state area. It'll cost you at least $1 million, even if housing prices come down. And you borrow a ton of money. Let's say you borrow $800,000 to buy the house. So you bought the house. And you're very frugal. And over the next 5 years, what you do is you pay down the mortgage and you now have the only all equity financed house in your entire neighborhood. You decide to have a mortgage burning party. Have you heard of these? In the old days, when people used to take 30-year mortgages, they would pay off their mortgage. And when the last mortgage payment was paid and they fully owned their house, they would actually physically burn their mortgage papers. They'd invite all their neighbors over, have coffee, cake, and orange juice, and whatever else they served at these parties. And they would burn the mortgage papers. Once in a while, they'd burn the house down with it. You know, kind of an ironic tragedy. But you know, let's assume you decide that to have a mortgage burning party. You invite all your neighbors over, and you've invited your next door neighbor, Bob, who's never liked you. He doesn't like the shrubs you've picked. He doesn't like the way you cut your lawn, but he comes anyway, it's free food. And while he's sitting there, you know, eating your coffee cake and drinking your coffee, he's plotting his revenge. So after the party, here's what he does. He goes to the friendly neighborhood banker and he says, you know what? There's this all equity funded house that's worth $1 million in my neighborhood. Would you let me borrow $750,000 against the house? Here's where the analogy breaks down. You go to a banker and you try to borrow money on your neighbor's house. What's the banker going to say? Hey, it's not your house. You can't borrow money there. But let's say this is your friendly neighborhood bank. He says, okay, Bob, here's $750,000. So Bob gets $750,000 that he's borrowed against your house. and he now does a hostile acquisition of your house. Again, this is where the analogy breaks down. You're saying, how the heck do you do a hostile acquisition of your house? Well, in your case, let's assume you were stupid enough to put a quarter of the house in your in each of your kids' names, and your kids are not particularly loyal. They sell their shares. So your neighbor Bob has now done a hostile acquisition of your house, using your house as the backing to borrow $750,000. Thank God this can't happen with the house. But let's say you are the CEO of a publicly traded company. It's a $100 million company. It can afford to have $60 million debt. That's its optimal debt ratio. But you're a conservative CEO. You've chosen not to borrow money. So I look at your house. I'm a private equity guy, or I'm an activist investor. I look at your company and I say, look, your company is worth $100 million. You could borrow $60 million, but you haven't. So here's what I do. I go to the banker and I try to borrow $60 million against a company that doesn't belong to me. I'll probably run into the same brick wall I ran trying to borrow money on my neighbor's house, right? The banker's going to say, it's not your company. But here's where Mike Milken and Drexel Burnham changed the game in the 1980s. You know what they created? What did Drexel create that allowed? They created the junk bond market. And people think that until the 1980s, there were no junk bonds. Junk bonds have always existed. The difference that Drexel Burnham made is until the 1980s, if you were a junk bond company, if you were a company with junk bonds, you couldn't issue junk bonds. In other words, your bonds became junk after they were investment grade and issued as investment grade bonds. What Drexel Burnham created was an original issue junk bond market. You say, how does it help an acquirer? Here's what acquirers did in the 1980s. They went to the junk bond market and they issued bonds against this company they were planning to acquire. Remember, they don't own the company yet, but the way they accommodated for that is they said, we'll give you a 12% interest rate. They issued junk bonds because there was nothing to back it up other than the fact that they'd done this before. They'd raised $60 million in junk bonds and they bought out your company. In effect, they've used your assets to get the junk, but to issue the junk bonds, and they bought out your company. And right after they buy out your company, remember, you're a conservative CEO. So in addition to not borrowing money, what have you very conveniently accumulated in the company because you're conservative? What do conservative companies do? They accumulate a lot of cash. Let's say you have $25 million in cash. Not retained earnings, but cash. So here's what I do now. I've acquired a company with $60 million that I borrowed using your assets as backing. You know what I do right after I acquire a company? I take your cash and I pay down the debt I took using your assets. Can't get any easier for me. So when I'm an under-levered company and I'm potentially the target of a hostile takeover, I need to do something quickly to preempt that takeover. So let's think about the ways you can increase your debt ratio quickly. One is you can do what's called a debt for equity swap, especially with really small companies. Here's how it works. You go to your equity investors in the company. Some of them are planning to sell shares, maybe buy corporate bonds in another company, and say, hey, I'll save you the trouble. I will give you bonds of equivalent market value. So both, you're not taking advantage of anybody. You're taking somebody with $20 million of equity in your company and offering them $20 million in bonds in your company. It's a debt for equity swap. And what that does overnight is change your debt ratio from 0% or 5% to 30 or 40%. That works for really small companies. But if you're a $1 billion company or a $10 billion company or a $100 billion company, that becomes difficult to do. So here's what you do instead. You go out and borrow $40 billion. You're allowed to do that. You issue bonds. And once you got the $40 billion, you either pay a special dividend or you buy back stock. You say, what does that do? A special dividend reduces the value of your equity by the amount of the dividend. It basically makes your equity smaller. A buyback accomplishes exactly the same effect. You buy back shares, and when you do a buyback, you actually get rid of those shares. You reduce your share count, you buy back shares. Both of those reduce your equity, and because you borrowed money, your debt goes up. Overnight again, you can increase your debt ratio. So if you're the potential target of a hostile takeover, and you don't have to see the news story, you would have to do this. So the question then becomes, now when you do this for your company, how do you decide whether you're potentially the target of a hostile takeover? Let me go through some criteria and you help me out. Let's take the size of your company. Let's say Microsoft is underlevered, and Microsoft is underlevered. and if any of you are doing Microsoft and you do the optimal, it is an underlevered firm. So Microsoft is underlevered. And let's assume that I do the same thing on a small NASDAQ company, which is also a tech company with a lot of income relative to its value. And it's also underlevered. Which of these two companies is more likely to be the target of a hostile takeover? Microsoft or a small company? I would say a small company, right? What's the problem with trying to do a hostile takeover of Microsoft? Hey, if you have a company that's close to $1 trillion, I don't care how open the bond market is, going on issuing $400 billion in the bond market is not easy to do. So first thing you'll be looking at is the size of your company. If you have an underlevered, very large company, it's less likely to be the target of a hostile takeover than an underlevered small company. One of the things that's happened over the last 30 years is the size of the company, which can be in a hostile takeover, has potentially gone up. I mean, 30 years ago, if you were a $10 billion company, you were potentially safe. Today, you might need to be a $100 billion company to be potentially safe. So look at the size of your company. That's the first. Second, you know, the second reason Microsoft is going to be difficult to do a hostile acquisition on, in addition to being a really big company, what else is going to make it difficult for me to do a hostile acquisition? One is the lack of hard assets, but think about shareholding. Who holds shares in the company and think of why that might get in the way. Microsoft doesn't have dual class shares, but Shashanka raises an interesting point. It's going to be almost impossible for me to do a hostile acquisition of a company like, you know, Facebook or, but it's, while Microsoft doesn't have two classes of shares, it does have insider holdings. Bill Gates still owns a big chunk of shares and he's not going to sell to a hostile acquirer. Steve Ballmer still owns a big chunk of shares. So one of the things I would look at for your company is who owns shares in your company. Go back to that page you printed off from Bloomberg. If you forgot to print off the page, not a big deal. Go to Yahoo Finance and look up the top 15 shareholders. And look to see whether there are any insiders on that list. Because if you have two or three big inside shareholders owning 5, 10, 15% of the shares, it made your job not impossible, but much more difficult. In fact, that's one reason doing a hostile acquisition of a family-controlled company like Tata, of any of the Tata Group, is going to be almost impossible to do. It's a shareholder structure. So two things. One is the size of the company. The second is the shareholder structure. There's a third factor. In every hostile acquisition, you get a fight between two sides, right? You've got the hostile acquirer on one side, and you've got the incumbent managers on the other. And for once in your life, shareholders are the center of attention. Both sides are trying to get you to listen to them. So what's the incumbent manager saying? Hey, don't trust the hostile acquirer. He's going to ruin your company. Don't sell to him. And what's the hostile acquirer saying? Hey, don't trust the incumbent managers. They don't have your best interests at heart. And for once, you get to decide who to trust. See, let me throw in a third factor. Let's assume you are shareholders in a company where the stock has done incredibly badly over the last 5 or 10 years. It's down 80%. Who are you going to trust? The incumbent managers say, look, we have your best interests at heart. The hostile acquirer says, hey, don't trust those guys. They don't have your best interests. I think in this case, the hostile acquirer. And Rizwana, why is that? Why would you trust the hostile acquirer?
Well, because the existing management has not been performing well. Yes. So I don't think that they have the ability to manage the company well.
Trust is built on performance, right? If you have a history of screwing me over, why should I trust you? Why should I trust you in an acquisition? So you want to measure how well or badly your stock has done in the recent past after adjusting for the market and after adjusting for risk. Let me repeat that again. You need a measure of how well or badly your stock has done after adjusting for the market and after adjusting for risk. Is there something you already should have as a number that you can use to make a judgment on this? Assuming you've been keeping up with the project at the subtle nag. Is there something we've computed already?
Jensen's alpha.
A Jensen's alpha. Remember, a Jensen's alpha computes how well or badly you've done and adjusts for risk and adjusts for the market performance. And if your Jensen's alpha is positive, you outperform the market. If your Jensen's alpha is negative, you underperform. So let me give you my trifecta for when you should get really worried in your company. If you have a small to mid-sized company, 3 billion, 5 billion even, that is small or mid-sized, which is underlevered. So let's assume you have an underlevered company, small or mid-sized. There is no significant insider holding or family control, and there are no dual class shares, and your Jensen's alpha is a negative number, a big negative number. Don't wait for a hostile acquisition. You need to do something quickly. If your company is larger or it has some control structure that makes it difficult to do an acquisition, or it has a big positive Jensen's alpha, your hand became a lot stronger and you can say, I'm not a potential takeover target. So let me pause right there and kind of, you know, and I want you to kind of think about what we just talked about. So you have an underlevered firm. Your first stop is my firm a potential takeover target? So are there any questions about that you know, that part of what we've done? So look at what you already have on your company, and you should have the ammunition to make this judgment of whether it's a yes or a no. Because if it's a yes, you need to do something quickly. Go ahead, Rami.
I guess I'm just wondering, what is the trade-off between thinking about trying to protect yourself from becoming a target versus, you know, increasing your cost of debt, which has other costs? How do we determine that trade-off?
Well, remember the higher cost of debt is already in your cost of capital, right? Your cost of capital is lower because when we computed the cost of capital, we were realistic. We incorporated the effect of borrowing money in the cost of debt. So for Disney, at a 40% debt ratio, their cost of debt will be higher than a 12%. But in spite of the higher cost of debt, we have a higher cost of capital. So we're saying even with distress cost and bankruptcy cost built in, it's better for this firm to borrow money than not borrow money. So we have incorporated the risk of bankruptcy into the cost of capital already. And even with that risk, we brought it in. Now you might say, look, I don't want to become a double B or a single B rated company. That's a legitimate point. And that's why we put a rating constraint. So think of your optimal as what you've decided is reasonable for your company with constraints built in. So you're not just going 50% debt, I'm okay with a single B rating. You're saying 30% is my optimal with a single A or a triple B rating constraint. So we're not being unreasonable in the optimal because you get to decide that optimal. It's not set by a spreadsheet. I'm saying if your optimal with those constraints built in is higher than the actual, and your company is potentially the target of a takeover, you've already incorporated that trade-off. You're not being reckless.
Right, thanks.
Ruksha?
I suppose it's not so different from Rami's question, but it seems like we've sort of put in themes of, you know, there's exogenous parties that are going to make a judgment about your capital structure and they're going to act on it.
Right.
And then there's your internal assessment of what the risks are.
Right.
But don't you have an impetus to meet the external expectations? Because
in other words, that's why we do a synthetic rating, right? Because in a sense, when we do the synthetic rating, we're trying to assess what the ratings agencies and the bondholders will think about us borrowing money. When we do the levered beta, we're trying to assess what equity investors will think about the risk. And I didn't quite mention this when I did the optimal capital structure spreadsheet, but I actually bend over backwards there to get the most conservative rating I can. At a 40% debt ratio, because I make all the debt you take come up to the new rate, even though you might have old debt at a low rate. So I try my best to be conservative in my estimates because I'd rather end up undershooting my optimal than overshooting it. But I'm still making judgments on what those outside groups will think about me after I borrow money. So I'm trying. So I might be wrong, but I think if I'm wrong, I'm going to undershoot rather than overshoot.
Okay, thank you.
So,
I have a question. Like you discussed about a large company like Microsoft, which is underlevered, and you said that it wouldn't be as easy for a hostile acquisition to happen for such companies. So then, should such companies still try to maintain the optimal debt ratio even if they're underlevered?
We'll talk about that because in the next phase, I'm going to give you, because what you have now is a buffer, right? You can decide what to do. You have more freedom. and you might decide to preserve that excess debt capacity. Why? Well, just in case there's a crisis like this one, or because what that's going to give companies like Microsoft is immense ammunition, right? Because in a crisis like this, if you have excess debt capacity, you have a lot of cash, you're going to be able to buy companies at bargain basement prices. I mean, who knows what prices some of these travel? I mean, if Microsoft wanted to buy, a piece of some other online business, which has been battered by this crisis, they might be able to do it at a bargain. So I think that having that buffer is great because it gives you flexibility. We'll talk about whether you should use that flexibility, but that's what it gives you. It gives you an advantage.
So shouldn't the optimal debt ratio be adjusted for these sort of advantages?
No, the optimal hasn't changed. The fact is you've given yourself room to kind of move to the optimal. The optimal doesn't come down because you have a buffer. You just have a bigger buffer, right? Your optimal is still there. You're still leaving money on the table, but that money is just the taxpayer money. And you might say, what I gain by preserving flexibility is far greater than what I lose by moving to the optimal. There's a trade-off here, right? By moving to the optimal, you are getting that tax benefit from debt, but you're giving up that buffer, which might be very valuable in the case of an emergency, a crisis, a downturn, or whatever else might hit you.
Thank you.
Hi, Professor.
Go ahead.
So in a hostile takeover, you said if a company takes on more debt, then you're more immune, but wouldn't a hostile acquirer be still able to take on the same amount or similar amount of debt and then acquire the company, refinance the debt holder?
In a sense, what I've done is I've taken away, because if I didn't do it, he would then get the entire tax benefit of debt. Let's say I do it first. My value is already going to go up to reflect the tax benefit, right? The hostile acquirer now has to pay a premium on that price. And if he continues now to borrow extra money, because I've already used up the debt capacity, he can't use the existing debt capacity. He now has to become over-levered. So what I'm doing is I'm preempting him by using the debt. Because once I've used the debt, he can't use that debt capacity. I've moved to the optimal.
Can the debt not be refinanced with a new debt or something like that? Or
it'll be at the same rate, right? So there's no benefit once I've already gone to the optimal. It's not like he can refinance at a lower rate. If he does, he's using his debt capacity, not mine. So I've already used my debt capacity. I'm at a fair cost of debt. I've left no subsidies for him on the table. Mm. There's no free lunch for him.
Okay.
Yeah. And as Chad points out, what I'm doing is I'm keeping the tax benefit for my shareholders rather than letting the acquirer capture it for himself. I'm saying, why should I give you a freebie? It's my shareholders' debt capacity. I'm going to claim it for him. In fact, this is not an abstraction. In the early 90s, there was a study of recaps. Recaps are what companies do exactly what I described, borrow money and buy back stock. And I think there were 93 recaps in the study, and 89 of the recaps were triggered by hostile acquisition bids. In other words, the recaps happened because existing management woke up and said, no, we need to do this ourselves. Otherwise, somebody's going to do this to us.
Okay, so
that's if you're underlevered and if you're a takeover target. What if you're not a takeover target? Then I'm going to ask you, so let's assume you're a large company or you have dual class shares, you have the luxury of time. So I'm going to take a vicious question and take it to the next level. So what do I do if I'm not a takeover target? Then I'm going to ask you, does your company have good products? Now, again, if you've been looking at your return on capital, return on equity, you have a sense at least of that already, right? So if your company has good projects, it earns a return on capital well above the cost of capital, then I'm going to argue that the best thing you can do with your debt is actually not go out and borrow money and buy back stock, but borrow money and take projects. Why is borrowing money and taking projects always going to give you a superior answer, if your projects are good projects, going to give you a superior answer than borrowing money and buying back stock? What do you get when you borrow money and take projects you could not have got if you borrowed money and bought back stock? Rizwana says the value of your stock increases, but that's the effect, right? Perry said positive net present value. Perry, help me out here. Tell me what happens when I borrow money and take a good project. What's the effect on value?
Well,
So the definition for me of a good project would be the return is more than the cost of capital for that.
Or a positive project. Net present value, right?
I would have a positive net present value. But if I'm just buying back my equity or like repaying my debt, that I am actually getting a return of the cost of capital, more or less.
In fact, Perry's point is very good. Remember what we said, what happens when you take a project with a positive net present value? Your value as a company increases by the value of that project, right? So you can see why when I borrow money and take good projects, I get a double whammy. The first whammy is when I borrow money and move to my optimal, I get all those tax benefits of debt. I get the increase in value we computed for Disney of $19 billion. But now if I take a build a theme park in Shanghai, which has a $5 billion NPV, I get the $19 billion I'd have got with the increase in debt plus the extra $5 billion in net present value of good projects. That is why I find it odd when companies say, well, I have excess debt capacity, therefore I'm going to buy back stock. I say, wait, don't you have good projects? Because if you have good projects, I think the superior decision is to borrow the money and take good projects. There's nothing in corporate finance that puts you on autopilot towards buying back stock. That's a me too-ism. Companies do it because they've been told by bankers, if you buy back stock, you'll have to get share dilution, you'll reduce your share count, it increases your share price. That's not why your value is increasing when you buy back shares. It's because you're moving towards your optimum. So if you have good projects, I'd say go out and take those good projects with debt. And if you don't have good projects, now your return on capital is barely meeting your cost of capital, then I'm going to ask you to return more cash to your shareholders over time. This is what the luxury here is. If you're not under pressure, you can move your debt ratio gradually over time, like Apple has. Apple has increased its debt ratio from 0% 7 years ago to about 12% now. But it's done it by borrowing $20 billion, $30 billion a year because they're able to do it gradually. They're under no pressure to do it. And the advantage of doing things gradually is each year you can stop and say, am I moving in the right direction? Is this okay? Am I overshooting or undershooting? As Rukshan pointed out earlier, I could have screwed up on how other people would look at my borrowing money. This way I can do it in small steps. So if you're under-levered, first question is, am I a takeover target? If you're a takeover target, increase your debt ratio quickly. If you're not a takeover target, ask yourself, do I have good projects? The answer is that you have good projects. And you can make that answer by, you can answer that question by looking at your return on capital and cost of capital. Then the pathway you should give for your project is you have debt capacity, don't do anything crazy right now, but use the debt capacity over time to take more projects. In other words, use a disproportionate amount of debt on your new projects, and over time your debt ratio will climb. It'll do it gradually and you'll be less risk, you'll be less risk prone. But if you don't have good projects and you have no immediate need to take on debt, then increase your debt ratio gradually by either increasing dividends or buying back small amounts of shares every year. That's your under-levered scenario. Any final questions about the under-levered scenario? Because some of you might have under-levered companies and I want you to go through that framework to decide what's right for you. Okay, so let's move to the more unpleasant scenario. What if your firm is over-levered? What if the actual debt ratio is greater than the optimal? There again, you have to stop and ask a question about immediacy. But here your question is not, am I going to be a takeover target? It's, am I under threat of bankruptcy? If you're under threat of bankruptcy, you need to do something quickly, right? So let's stop and ask a question about your company. Is my firm under threat of bankruptcy? You're saying, what would I look at to make a judgment? Any ideas, folks, on what I should look at to make a judgment on whether my firm is under threat of bankruptcy? Eric, what is DSCR?
To see if you have enough money to cover your debt. So,
okay. So you're going to look at your cash flows. So you're going to look at the interest coverage ratio. And if you have a rating, you're going to look at whether you've been putting on a rating downgrade. Let's be quite honest. If you're under threat of bankruptcy, you know, right? So if you're in the company, absolutely. You know, because everything is now being rationed out. You're asked to bring your own toilet papers. It's too expensive for us to buy. If any of you have worked at companies which are in trouble, you know you're in trouble. In fact, right now, you know what companies are in trouble because they're having trouble making their debt payments in the next 6 months. So if you are under threat of bankruptcy, either because you have a terrible rating, your interest coverage ratio has collapsed, your earnings next year are going to be terrible, then you need to reduce debt quickly, right? This is perhaps the most challenging thing to do in business. I mean, imagine being the CEO of United Airlines or any airline today, or at Boeing. No, because you can already see why reducing debt quickly is so difficult to do. Let's look at some of the options you're given. And think, and so let me throw the options at you and you tell me why this is going to be. So put yourself in the shoes of the CEO of pretty much any airline today. Hey, why don't you try an equity for debt swap? You know what that is? You go to your bondholders and your bankers and you offer them equity in your company in exchange for the debt. What's the challenge of trying to do that as an airline today? Not only is your equity not worth much, it's you're saying, I'm not sure whether the equity is going to go to zero. So your first challenge when you're in trouble is, hey, nobody wants to your shares because they're worried the share price will go to zero. So that didn't work. Why not sell assets? Why aren't the airlines selling, routes and aircraft or whatever they have as assets? What's the problem with selling assets to bring down the debt right now? Who's going to buy your assets? All the potential buyers are in trouble with you. So that's not going to be that easy. No, what if you could renegotiate with the lenders? You see why this is your only option if you're in real trouble? And what's your biggest bargaining chip? If you're an airline and I'm your banker, what is it that you're going to use as your bargaining chip to get the best possible terms from me? What are you going to threaten to do? You're going to threaten to go bankrupt, right? You see, what's the big deal about going bankrupt? When you go bankrupt, where do you end up? You end up in bankruptcy court. You know what happens when you end up in bankruptcy court? Time loses all meaning. Now, I still remember in the mid-1990s when I became a citizen of the United States. And I was very proud of being a citizen. And about 3 months after I became a U.S. citizen, I got reminded of one of my duties as a citizen. I got a letter in the mail, asking me to show up for jury duty. And to show you how naive I was actually excited about being a juror. So I actually circled the date on the calendar. I tell my wife, remind me, I've got to show up as a juror. So I show up that day expecting balloons and party cakes. And I walk into this room and this incredibly bored-looking woman sitting behind the table. And she says, what are you here for? I said, I was called as a juror. And she said, go sit in that chair. And I said, what do I do? And she says, what's that terminal up there? And I said, what am I watching for? Your number. And I said, what number? She said, there's a number on your juror summons. And I said, okay. I'll watch for the number. I said, what if that number doesn't show up? She said, come back again tomorrow. And I said, I can't keep coming back every day. I have a job. I have to go teach. And she said, don't worry about that. We pay you. And I said, how much do you pay? And she said, $5 a day. And I said, that settles it. I'll come back here for the rest of my life. But that kind of gives you a small window on what happens once you end up in bankruptcy court, right? Time loses all meaning. It could take decades for you to get your money back as a lender. So guess what borrowers through time have used as a bargaining chip? Hey, look, if you don't agree to our terms, we're going to throw ourselves at the mercy of the bankruptcy court and you might never see your money. And you try to extract the best possible terms. I know it sounds almost borderline unethical, but it's the only chip you have to play. So you try to renegotiate the best terms. And to give you kind of a story, it's kind of a funny story on how people have used this advantage to maximum effect. I'll give you a story about a Latin American country. I don't remember the country. I don't want to insult the wrong country, but Latin America, of course, is the hotbed for sovereign default. So this is the late 1800s, a Latin American country has borrowed money from a French bank. And the time to make payment comes about and the Latin American country lets the French bank know that they can't repay the debt. But they're willing to offer something else in return. They say, well, we don't have the money to pay the debt, but we'll pay with guano. You know what guano is? It's bird droppings. It's good fertilizer. But they said, we can load up lots of guano on ships and send it to you in France. And the first reaction of the French bank was, hey, we don't want your fish, your bird droppings. We want money. And the Latin American country says, would you like bird droppings? Would you like nothing? The bank thought about it for a moment and said, hey, we'll take the bird droppings. So I'm not suggesting that airlines offer bird droppings as payment, but I'm saying your strength, your bargaining strength in a weird way is greatest on, when you're on the verge of going bankrupt. And you might be able to reuse that to renegotiate your debt to give yourself more time. So if you have too much debt, not a great problem to have. And if you have to do something quickly, not too many great solutions. You do the best you can to get yourself some time. So if you have too much debt, pray and hope you're not under threat of bankruptcy, because then your options become much more limited. If you're not under threat of bankruptcy, why? Because you got a bailout, you got, you know, something kind of giving you time. Then ask yourself the same question you had before. Does your firm have good projects? Again, look at the same things you did when you had too little debt. If you look at the return on capital versus the cost of capital, look at the net present value of your projects. Because if you have good projects and you have time as your ally, here's what you should be doing. You should be using a disproportionate amount of equity. And you're saying, how do I do that? With, you know, take every dollar you earn, don't pay any dividends. In fact, if you're over-leveraged, what the heck are you doing paying dividends or buying back stock? You should be taking every dollar you have, putting it into those projects, because here again, you get a double whammy. As you use that equity to fund those projects, you get a positive net present value and you move further and further away from being over-leveraged towards your correct leverage. So if you're over-levered, you're not under bankruptcy threat and you have good projects, then take good projects with retained earnings. Or if you can issue new equity over time, go ahead and do it. If you don't have good projects, then again, you need to pay down your debt. So I would suggest cutting out dividends, no buybacks, take every dollar of earnings you have and use it to pay down the debt. If I were mapping out a plan for any of the airlines, I would say, look, your first priority has to be paying down the debt. Because you're over-levered. You now have had a very harsh lesson that you've over-levered. Every dollar you make from now on. So whether you have restrictions on dividends and buybacks is almost irrelevant. You should be using your money to bring your debt ratio down. And if you feel at some point in time opportunities are opening up where you can take positive net present value projects, use your equity to take those projects. So that's a big picture of the framework. Any questions? So think about your company, think about anything that comes on any of those branches, and you know, let's talk about it. Any questions? Ruksha?
Just broadly, it sort of seems like if we're summing up the approaches to you're getting your capital structure, there's the optimal in the center, and at the extreme on under-leverage, you're at the risk of takeover, and at the extreme on over-leverage, you're at the risk of bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to summarize kind of the risks in between? What if you're in between being under-levered and you're optimal?
Well, think of it as a continuum, right? If you're under immediate threat of bankruptcy, you have almost no time. You've got to do something almost overnight. If you're like Apple or Microsoft, you have almost infinite time. There's nobody who's going to come after you. You might have a Carl Icahn making noise. And Carl Icahn actually made some noise at Apple. But he discovered that Apple is so big that you can make noise, but the effects you can have are small. So I would say you'd fall somewhere in that continuum. You're going to think in terms of years rather than in terms of, you know, a scale. How many years do I have before pressure builds up on you? Because pressure will build up if you're under level. And the question is it going to build up in 2 years, 5 years, 7 years? That's how much time you have to do something with your debt capacity and to earn the trust from your shareholders. Because if you earn trust, they're going to let you keep that debt capacity, right? Because they're going to trust you and say, okay, you're Google, you have a history of taking good projects. I'm okay with you being under-levered.
And then maybe just to tack onto that, are there specific triggers that you'd note on either side of that spectrum?
I'll tell you what you should, if you're an outsider, if you're within, inside the company, you have internal triggers you can look at, right? You're doing the net present values of projects. If you have lots of great projects, you have excess debt capacity, then you have an incentive to speed up the taking of those projects because you can now raise capital. You know you have the capacity to raise capital. From outside of the company, you're looking at, you know, what's the company reporting as earnings? What kind of projects is it taking? Is it moving with urgency? So I would say that, you know, looking at the actions of a company, you can get a sense of what they're doing with their debt capacity and perhaps, you know, pushing them in the right direction.
Thank you.
So I'm going to try to apply this to Disney, because I, you know, as I said, I have at least the ammunition now to do this. So if you remember, for Disney, my actual debt ratio was 11.6%. My optimal was 40%, both the APV approach and the cost of capital approach and the enhanced cost of capital approach. So they're under level. So first question I asked, and this was in 2013, is my firm a potential target of a takeover? And I said no, for two reasons. Its market cap is $130 billion, making it a fairly large company. It's not an Apple, it's not a $1 trillion company, but $130 billion is pretty big. Its Jensen's alpha, if you remember, was 9.01%. It was a big positive number. And it had gained an element of trust from investors. But to show you how this judgment has shifted over time, in 1997, when I did the first edition of this book, remember, Disney's always been a constant, I made the same judgment. In 1997, they were a $80 billion, $70 billion company. I said they're a big company by 1997 standards. That Jensen's alpha was positive. I said they're not the potential target of a takeover. In 2002, when I did my second edition, I actually wavered. Why? Because the market cap had dropped by almost 50% over the previous 6 years. They were run by one of the most hated CEOs in the US at that time, Michael Eisner, who had a history of overriding shareholders. And their Jensen's alpha was a big negative number. In 2002, I actually concluded that they were potentially the target of a hostile takeover. And this was just before they were targeted by Comcast. So Disney is a company that in 2013 looks pretty safe, but nothing is forever. This could very quickly change if your market cap collapses and people lose trust in you. But in 2013, I said they're not a potential target of a takeover. Then I asked, do they have good projects? You know how I answered this question? I looked at the return on capital. It was 12.61%. You remember that was way back in packet one, well above their cost of capital, which was 7.8%. So I said, they have a history of taking good projects. I think they have the capacity to keep doing it. So I said, hey, they have debt capacity. I'm going to give them that freedom to use that debt capacity to take projects. It'd be silly for me to push them into buybacks. So at least for Disney, that was my judgment. I'll give you one final factor to consider when you think about, is my company a potential target of a hostile takeover? Take a look at what the top management is talking about. If the top management starts to talk about how concerned they're about shareholders, that's a sign of fear. You know, it's because I still remember about 20 years ago when Telecom Italia, at that time, large publicly traded Italian company, was acquired in a hostile acquisition. It was one of the first hostile acquisitions on European soil, because until then, Europeans thought about hostile acquisitions as an Anglo-Saxon phenomenon. Those barbarians in the US and the UK, they take each other over, but we're polite in Europe. We don't do stuff like that. And Telecom Italia happens, and it shook a lot of corporate CEOs in Europe to the core, because they said, this can't happen in Europe. So I was actually on a panel of discussions in right after this happened, about a year after it happened. It was, I don't know where, maybe in Switzerland, Zurich or Geneva somewhere. And I was in the panel, and my job is to do nothing but to be the master of ceremonies. So I hate doing that, because you can't say what's in your mind. So I was sitting next to the CEO of Siemens, and the CEO of Siemens gets up, I forget his name, he says, our focus in Siemens is on shareholders. We care deeply about shareholders. And I almost fell out of my chair, because I know how Siemens thinks about the shareholders. It thinks about them the same way that I think about mosquitoes. They're irritants that you get rid of once every year. And you know, so when I heard this guy talk about shareholder wealth maximization, my reaction was the same one as when I heard Madonna sing Like a Virgin. Reactions, how would you know? Yeah. So when you hear CEOs who never cared about their shareholders talk about how much they care about shareholders, it must mean that they're terrified. It must mean that there's a threat of a takeover in the air. Otherwise, why would they even talk about shareholder wealth maximization? So think of Madonna, think about CEOs in your company, and take a look at what they're talking about. If they're talking a lot about shareholders, and they're underlevered, there's something going on that is scaring them. And that should be something you should factor into your analysis as well. So that was my Disney judgment. Rukshin, you have another question, or your hand is up from before?
From before, I'll put it down.
Okay. So now try this for your company. As I said, there's nothing more effective than doing this for your company to see the framework play out. So do the actual, do the optimum. If your firm is underlevered, ask yourself, am I the potential target of a takeover? If it's overlevered, am I under threat of bankruptcy? Because that's going to determine whether you should have an immediate change or a gradual change, whether you have time as your ally, whether you don't. And once you decide on that path of urgent or slowly, then ask a follow-up question. What's the best way for me to change my debt ratio? Should I be buying back stock or retiring debt, you know, depending on whether you're over or under-levered? Or should I be taking projects? The answer to that will depend on how good your projects are. So the urgency question will be determined by whether the threat of a takeover or bankruptcy. The question of how you should move your debt ratio will depend on what kind of projects you think you have. Because if you want to change your debt ratio quickly, there are, as I said, a couple of ways you can do it. One is, if you want to decrease your debt ratio, as I said, the more difficult problem, you have to sell assets. Tough to do, and use the cash to pay down debt or try to issue new stock to retire debt. Both of those options are difficult options, and that's why I said try not to overshoot your debt ratio. If you're underlevered, much easier options, right? You can, to increase the debt ratio, you can sell operating assets, and because you're in good shape, you can use that cash to buy back stock or pay a dividend. Or you can borrow money and buy back stock, do a recapitalization. So what you're effectively doing is making a judgment on moving your debt ratio quickly. Okay? To change your debt ratio gradually over time, if you're looking at equity, you can do it by increasing your dividends. Increasing dividends will reduce your equity over time because every time dividends leave your company, your equity value decreases. It shows up as a drop in your stock price on the ex-dividend day. Or you can do a buyback, which reduces your share count. If you've got to bring your debt down, you're going to have to retire bonds or repay bank loans. So that's how you change your debt ratio gradually over time. Now, one of the issues in terms of mechanics, if they ask you to bring your debt ratio down from or increase your debt ratio from 0% to 40% over the next 5 years, the dollar debt you will have 5 years from now at a 40% debt ratio will actually be different from the dollar debt today because the company itself is growing. So mechanically, figuring out what a 40% debt ratio is gets a little messier if you're doing it over time than if you're doing it instantaneously. You know what I'm talking about? If the value of your firm is $1 billion and you want to move to 40% today, well, the amount of debt you need is $400 million. But if you say, well, I want to move my debt ratio to 40% 5 years from now, your value as a firm is not going to stay at $1 billion for the next 5 years. It is going to change. You'll have to have 40% of your expected value as a firm 5 years from now. Ruksha?
Sorry, one more question.
Yeah.
How should we think about kind of the signaling of this sort of movement? So let's say that your company announces that they're, you know, have a 5-year plan to move to a specific capital structure. You know, does that immediately turn into value for the company because of reduced indirect bankruptcy costs or takeover costs or something? You know, is there an indirect signaling addition?
There is an indirect signaling, and it's actually very ironic. When you announce you're going to issue equity, and this goes back to the financing hierarchy, when you announce you're going to be issuing equity over the next 5 years to retire debt, let's suppose you have two companies in the same sector. One is say they're going to be raising equity to retire debt. The other says they're going to be borrowing money to take projects or buy back stock. Which one do you think is healthier? I mean, think like an outsider looking at these two companies. All you see are the announcements. Which one do you think is in better financial health? The one that announces it's going to be issuing equity, the one that's going to announce that it's going to be borrowing money? I know it's very superficial, but I'd argue that the company that's announcing it's going to borrow money is probably healthier. And that's why it might be the false signal. But usually if you look at what stockholders do, they push up stock prices when companies announce they're going to be issuing debt. And they push down stock prices when they announce they're going to be issuing equity. I'm not sure that announcing that you're going to borrow money in this market at this point in time would be a great idea, because I don't know what kind of signals it, but if you look at across time, generally the signaling effect of issuing debt is usually more positive than the signaling effect of issuing equity.
Thank you.
today, if you're a distressed firm, it might be a good signal for you to issue equity, because the fact that you feel confident enough that you can raise equity can be a good thing. So the signaling effect is subtle. It depends on the timing and depends on who you are as a company. So now let's open up the second part of the financing principle. What's the right kind of debt for you? So I'll tell you let's look back at the pluses and minuses of debt as opposed to equity. What's the biggest advantage of issuing debt again?
Tax advantage?
It's a tax advantage. What's the biggest advantage of using equity?
No,
flexibility, right? You can make debt payments, you get less restrictions. So equity gives you flexibility and freedom. Debt gives you tax advantage. You know what your perfect financing instrument would be? It'd be a financing instrument that gives you the tax advantages of debt and the flexibility of equity. Wouldn't it be great if you could do that? I mean, what you're doing is creating almost a cross-dressing security, a security that behaves like debt when the tax guy is around and behaves like equity with you. That's your perfect financing. You're saying, there's no way I can do that. Let's try. Let's think about why you want to try to create debt that behaves like equity. And I'm going to use a very simplistic example to illustrate my case for why you should design debt that behaves like equity. Let's say you have a company. The value of the company goes up and down. Why you're a cyclical company or a commodity company? So the value of the company goes through. That's so you see the line that goes through. That's my value as a company. If you issue debt that stays fixed no matter what, so think of that as a constant, this company is in trouble, right? Every time the value of the company drops below the value of the debt, you're effectively bankrupt. You're saying, what's the big deal? What if I could issue debt that moved with my equity? I know it's almost an impossible dream, but let's hang in there. Let's assume I issued debt that moved up when my equity moved up, when my firm is worth a lot, and moved down when my firm is worth less, and moved up again. This firm actually has twice as much debt as the firm I had in the previous picture, but it never goes bankrupt. That's my end game. I want to design debt that behaves like equity. So let's play a little game. Let's assume you're a company and you want me to design your perfect debt for you. So what's my perfect debt? My perfect debt is cash flows that move up when my cash flows are high and move down when my cash flows are low. So you ready? I'm going to come and ask you a series of questions, and I'm going to use your answers to design your perfect debt for you. So here's my first question. Tell me what your typical project looks like in terms of duration. Is it a really long-term project or a really short-term project? So let me give you two examples. Let's say your company is Boeing. I'm going to ask you, how long-term is your project? What's your answer going to be? What's a typical project for Boeing look like? Probably 40, 50, 60 years, right? Because think about the R&D they do. And I'll give you just to give you a concrete example. Think about the Boeing 747, the jumbo jet. The R&D for the jumbo jet started in the 1950s. The first jumbo jet, I think, rolled off the assembly lines in the 1970s. The last one rolled off the assembly lines probably 10 years ago. The jumbo jet as a project lasted almost 60 years. And you take the 707, the 727, the 737. A typical Boeing project lasts 30, 40, 50 years. In contrast, think about a typical project for Microsoft. It's much more short term, right? If you think about software companies, if you think about Adobe, much more short term. Not decades, but maybe 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. You're saying, so what? Hey, when I try to design debt, I want to create debt that matches your projects. If I'm designing the perfect debt for Boeing, it's going to be really long term debt. If I'm designing the perfect debt for Zoom, assuming it can borrow money, it's going to be much more short term. The duration of the project sets the duration of my debt. In fact, Boeing was one of two companies that in the late 90s issued 100-year corporate bonds. Usually corporate bonds have 10 years, sometimes they can be 20 years. Boeing was one of two companies that issued 100-year corporate bonds. And then you know what? It actually makes sense for Boeing. You know the other company was that in the 1990s issued 100-year corporate bonds? It was Disney. It was unusual, but again, there's a part of Disney where it makes sense, right? Which part of Disney's businesses do you think might be best suited for 100-year bonds? The theme parks, exactly. Very long-term projects. And in fact, Sam says intangible. That's an interesting point. If you think about Disney's, one of Disney's assets as brand name, maybe there's a portion of the business which is such a long-term portion of the value that maybe they should use debt, but they need to have cash flows coming from those intangibles to back it up. So what's the duration of your project? Second question I'm going to ask you is, what currency are your cash flows in? Let's say with Boeing. What's the answer going to be to that question? Well, it depends on who signed contracts with them, right? So if Singapore Airlines has signed contracts and they're going to pay in Singapore dollars, 30% of their revenues next year might be in Singapore dollars. You see, why does that matter? The currency breakdown of your revenue should the currency should match up to the currency breakdown for your debt. So in the case of Disney, if you remember, 82% of the revenues came in US dollars, 18% in foreign currencies. That's going to determine the currency mix for my debt. So everybody with me so far, the duration for your projects defines the duration for my debt. The currency in which I get the cash flows defines the currency mix for my debt. Then I'm going to ask you, how does inflation play out in your company? You say, what are you talking about? When you have inflation, you as a company are faced with a quandary, right? Your costs go up. Why? Because inflation affects your costs. If you have pricing power, you know what you're going to do. You're going to pass those inflation increases on to your customers. You're saying, why do I even care? Think of what drives the decision between fixed rate and floating rate debt. If you have floating rate debt, here's what happens. When interest rates are low, your interest payments are low. When interest rates go up, your floating rate goes up and your interest payments go up. If you have pricing power, you're a much better candidate for floating rate debt because here's what you do. When inflation is high, you pass it through to your customers, your income goes up. If your income goes up, you can afford much higher interest payments. If you don't have pricing power, you don't want to have floating rate debt because you will get squeezed. And here's what's going to happen. Inflation goes up, your costs go up, but you can't pass it through to your customers. Your income actually decreases. But if inflation goes up, your interest payments also, your interest rates go up and your interest payments tend to go up. You get squeezed. So the decision of whether to use fixed or floating rate debt will depend on whether you have pricing power. Let me pause right there to make sure that you're with me on that page, because the decision on fixed and floating rate debt is then determined by how much pricing power you have. The more pricing power you have, the better you are as a candidate for floating rate debt. Rukshin, you have a question, or is your hand up from before?
From before again.
Okay.
Hi, Professor. So on the duration front, I understand why, let's say if your project is very long-term, if you take short-term debt, your project might not generate cash in the short term to service.
No, it's not that you don't generate cash. It's that at the end of the short term, you have to refinance that debt. And if interest rates go up in the meantime, you haven't locked in the rates. So right now, rates are low, right? So let's say you have a long-term project and you take on long-term debt, you lock in the low rate, both in your cost of capital and your cost of debt. Whereas if you take short-term debt and 3 years from now, remember it's a long-term project, you need to refinance that debt. If interest rates change, you're going to get squeezed in the refinancing. That's why when you mismatch short-term debt against long-term assets, you're begging to be taken to the cleaners during the crisis.
Okay, so it's more about matching the cost and the return on your project.
Exactly. It's more about that, because otherwise you're playing a yield curve or a term structure game, and that's not a good thing to play in corporate finance. If you want to do that on the side, you can. But remember, then you're doing financial speculation. And if you're a steel company or a toll road company, I don't think that's a great idea. I don't think that's the game you should be playing.
And would that argument be the same for the other way around? Let's say if you take long-term debt for...
You find short-term projects, exactly the same reasons. Because, I mean, right now your defense might be rates are so low.
Yeah.
How much lower can they get? You know, for the last 12 years, companies have used that excuse for borrowing long-term. And rates, which are 3%, end up becoming 2.5%. I know rates are really low. They're more likely to go up than down. So maybe I will cut you some slack right now. But you're still violating a first principle in corporate finance. We use long-term debt to finance short-term projects.
So in that case, then your returns might move lower with the rates, exactly. But you're locked into a higher rate of financing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or you might have no projects and you have all this debt. I mean, it's, you know, why go looking for trouble?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
The fourth question I'm going to ask you, is there any other questions about the floating fixed rate debt issue?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I think you've already answered it. I just want, out of curiosity, if the interest rates are very low, at that point in time, irrespective of what kind, whether you can pass it off to your consumers or not, should you still not lock yourself at a fixed rate, or do you always have to take the refinance perspective into account?
You know what? Right now, both fixed and floating rates are low. I would go, I mean, it's not neither are, right? I think that locking in long-term rates because they're low, I think you could make the argument, but you have to be very clear about what you're doing. You're bringing interest rate speculation into your company. And as I said, your job as a company is to build toll roads, not to speculate in interest rates. Because when you borrow money at a really low rate, say interest rates are really low, you're also then saying their normal rates are much higher, they should go up. And you're speculating on interest rates. And as long as you don't overdo it, you probably won't get into trouble. But there is a danger you can overdo it. Because that's the argument a lot of airlines and Boeing used for borrowing a ton of money last year and 2 years ago, right? So you got to be careful to know when to stop.
Thank you.
Simon?
Yeah, my question is, so what then, I'm kind of confused on what the downside of having, or the upside of having short-term debt is then.
If you have short-term projects, I'll tell you why. I mean, that short-term debt is matched because you have projects right now that are positive net present value. So you take the short-term debt, you take the projects, and assuming you've done your estimation right, let's say the net present value turns positive. It's 3 years later, your projects have ended. Is there any guarantee that 3 years from now you're still going to have positive net present value projects? Do you see where I'm going? At the end of 3 years, what if your project stream has dried up or your projects have become long-term? Or, you know, by locking, or they become a project in a different country, right? You don't know what will happen at the end of 3 years. Why lock yourself into a currency and a maturity when you have no idea what 3 years from now will deliver? So by borrowing money long-term in dollars, what if your projects 3 years from now, short-term projects in China or in India or in Europe? So I don't see the benefit of locking yourself in other than the fact that you're speculating on interest rates, which was Rizwana's point. If your argument is rates are so low, they can't get any lower. Yeah, I'm willing to go along with that up to a point. And Rizwana says short-term debt is also used for working capital, only for the part of working capital is really long-term, right? The portion of inventory, that should be long-term debt. But a part of working capital is transient. For that, you use short-term debt. Okay, let's move on to the fourth question. Tell me something about your growth pattern. You say, what are you talking about? Are you a mature company with relatively low growth? Are you a high growth company where everything lies in the future? You're saying, why should that matter? Well, that's going to determine whether I use straight debt or convertible debt. And here's why. If you're a mature company where you don't have much growth in the future, I think you're a much better candidate for straight debt. Why? Because you can set a coupon rate and deliver on it. If most of your value lies in the future, if you have all of your cash flows coming in future growth, then you're a much better candidate for convertible debt. Let me explain why. What tends to be true about convertible, the coupon rates, let's say you're a company with straight debt with an 8% coupon rate. If you as a company issue convertible debt, what should be true about the coupon rate on convertible debt for the same company? Lower or higher? It's going to be much lower. And Nathan, why is it going to be much lower?
Because you're getting the value and the option to convert.
Exactly. You're buying a convertible bond, you're getting a conversion option. So when you issue convertible debt, your coupon payments tend to be much lower. You see why this is an advantage? If you're a growth company, your cash flows are probably low right now. Why? Because you need to reinvest a lot of money. The convertible debt keeps the coupon payments low. Eventually, that convertible debt will either get converted to equity, in which case you can replace it with straight debt if you're a mature company, or with more convertible debt. The advantage of a growth company from issuing convertibles is their fixed payments are low when they need to be low, which is right now. They will tend to get higher in the future when you can afford them with higher cash flows. So growth companies are much better candidates for convertible debt. Which brings me to my fifth and final question. I'm going to ask you to tell me what else affects your cash flows. Because you know what I'm going to try to do? I'm going to to try to be creative and build it into your debt. Let me give you an example. If you're an oil company, what's the biggest factor driving your earnings and cash flows every year? This is an easy one because we're right in the midst of a storm on it. It's oil prices, right? So wouldn't it be nice if you could issue bonds where the coupon rate was tied to the oil price? The oil price is low, the coupon rate is low. If oil prices are high, coupon rates are higher. It's doable. It's called a commodity-linked bond. The very first commodity-linked bonds were issued by silver mining companies in the early 1980s. And what they did was they allowed these commodity companies to borrow money, but then not go bankrupt if the commodity price collapsed. I know there are probably every oil company now wishes it had issued commodity-linked bonds. There must be a trade-off, right? Let's talk about the trade-off. The plus of issuing commodity-linked bonds, of course, is that that you reduce your defaulters. What's the minus? You're going to have to pay a much higher coupon rate, probably, right? So basically, when you issue commodity-linked bonds, you're reducing your default risk at the expense of a higher coupon rate. But you know what? I think it's a good trade-off. I have always wondered why oil commodity companies have not been bigger users of commodity-linked bonds. But one reason is hubris. I think many commodity companies believe that they can forecast commodity prices better than the rest of us. And because of that, they want to preserve that freedom. But I think that it's something to think about, tying it into your bond. You know. And I'll give you a second and final example, and then we'll kind of move on. I think it was about 20 years ago, somebody from this class, you know, went to work for Allstate Insurance and was pretty high up in the finance group. And she, you know, this was right after she joined the finance group. And she called me and she said, well, I'm going to do an optimal capital structure analysis for Allstate. And I'm going to present it to the finance group next week. And I said, no, call me after you've done the presentation. Let's see how it goes. So she did the optimal capital structure, found that Allstate was significantly underlevered. And she went in front of the finance group and said, we should borrow a lot more money. So I said, what happened? She said, well, I got pushback saying we can't borrow money. And when I asked why, she said, we're always one catastrophe away from going bankrupt, one disaster, an earthquake in Florida, flood earthquake in California, flood in Florida, a hurricane in the South. We're always one disaster away. So we have excess debt capacity. We know it, but we can't use it just in case. So here's what I'd like you to do. You're the CFO of a small insurance company. You want to borrow money because you know you have excess debt capacity, but you're worried about a disaster kind of putting you under. Is there a way you could build a bond to kind of allow you to borrow money but not put you under in the event of a disaster? Alex said catastrophe bonds. Alex, can you describe what a catastrophe bond is?
Or disaster? Sure. Go ahead. I think it's a bond where you promise a coupon payment or interest payment, and as long as there's no disaster happen, then that would stay. But if there's a disaster happen, then you're on the hook for something.
And it's a legal document. So you actually are explicit about the disaster, saying an earthquake that measures more than 6 on the Richter scale in California, or more than 7 on the Richter scale, or a hurricane that causes more than $5 billion in damage. If that happens, our coupon payments get suspended legally for 5 years. And our principal payments get halved by 50%. Shashanka says pandemic bonds. Exactly. That is exactly what people are talking about when they talk about bring the disaster. Let's talk about the trade-off again, because it sounds like a really good idea once a disaster happens, right? So what's the trade-off here? By issuing this bond, you protect yourself in the event of a disaster. But the trade-off is you'll have to pay a higher coupon rate. So that's something to think about, is when you design a bond, if you can make the bond the right bond for your company, you've in a sense reduced your disaster risk or default risk, but increased your capacity to borrow money. Let's do one final stop and then we'll end for the day. So let's say you've done this for your company. You've designed the perfect bond. And I want you to think about for your company, remember the company in your project, what the perfect bond would look like, both in terms of duration, currency, et cetera, and be creative. then make sure that you haven't been too clever for your own good. Let me explain. What have you done when you've created this bond that is flexible? You've designed a bond that looks like equity, right? In fact, you might have done such a good job that the IRS or the tax guy might look at you and say, you know what? That looks so much like equity. We're going to treat it as equity. In which case, all your hard work is down the drain because you no longer get the tax benefits of debt. So one of the things you got to make sure is when you design these creative bonds that you're still meeting the tax requirements for it to be in debt. And that will vary across locales. And you might have to finesse the bond to maximize your tax benefits. If you're a European company, for instance, issuing bonds, you want your bonds to be in Germany, not in Ireland, to get your maximum tax benefit. So you're finessing the bond to make sure you're getting the maximum tax benefit. So at the end of the first two stops, here's what you have. You have the perfect bond for your company, matches up your assets, and you've made sure that that bond gets you the tax benefits of debt. When we come back on Wednesday, I will complete the process by looking at designing the perfect debt and maybe becoming more specific about what it's going to look like. But start thinking about what the perfect bond is going to look like for your company. Because it's, you know, when we start class on Wednesday, you can bring up your company. So what would the perfect bond look like for a Coca-Cola, for a Zoom? And bring in what we've learned from crises to talk about how can we design debt that gives us some of the tax benefits without putting us under if there's a crisis or a disaster. Any final questions before we sign off?
So when we're designing a bond, are we supposed to take all these five aspects into account to ensure that the cash flows are completely matched, or do we pick and choose which aspects?
No, you want to be as matched as you can. You can't just have long-term and forget about the currency, right? They're not mutually exclusive. They're all parts of your project. So I would look into all five. Some might not be easy to answer for your company. Some might be easy. So in the case of an oil company, we know what that external factor is. But for other companies, it might require a little more creative thinking. But I would think about all five. It's not just two out of the five. You want to get as much matching as you can.
Okay, thank you.
Alex?
Professor. So if you are valuing an early growth companies, do you recommend us to do like this optimal capital structure calculation for like right now, as well as like when we expect them to be a mature company?
I think that might be a nice thing to do. And I'll tell you why. Later when you value these companies, you're going to have to change the debt ratio over time and knowing what their optimal will look like once they become mature. But I'll also tell you practically, it's really tough to do because think of how we do the optimal debt ratio. We need an operating income. We need market value. All of those things you'll have to now estimate for the company once it becomes a mature company. So you might want to just look at industry averages for that instead of trying to do an actual optimal debt ratio.
But in your model, don't we have like the, you know, like at end of year 10, like our projection of the cash flows?
You have the operating income, but you don't have the, see, what you don't have is the market value, right? Because you don't know what the market value will look like. So unless you want to use your terminal value as your market value, you could try that. Okay. If there are no other questions, we're going to sign off. Remember, again, I made it screwed up on your quiz date. It is a week from Wednesday. So I will send out again the links for reviewing for the quiz. It's, again, multiple choice like the last one. I'm sorry again about the fact that there is no way to get partial credit. But look very much like the last quiz. Five questions, 1 hour. You have plenty of time. So take your time and work through. And it's just going to be on the financing principles. So it's going to be on the first part of the second packet. I think slides 1 through 140 or so. So basically it's that first section of the second packet, but that's what the second quiz will cover. Okay. So I will see you on Wednesday. Take care.